Be fucking real, man. Come on.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Sword, Sorcery, and Socialism, a podcast about the politics and themes hiding under genre fiction. As always, I'm Asha, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ketho. How's it going?
Howdy.
Today, we are back with what might officially be our first short story, I think. Well, Binti was kind of a short story.
And Omalas.
Ah, yeah, you're right. Okay. It's our third short story. And honestly, I think, aside from Dark Fantasy, last October, it might be our first sort of horror, quote-unquote horror story.
Disturbing.
Anyway. We are here to talk about Harlan Ellison's famous sci-fi short story, I Have No Mouth, and I Must Scream. This was interesting.
Yeah,
I have very complicated feelings about this story. So I don't know if you want to start off by giving us your first impression. Because I don't know, have you read it before this?
I have not read it before this.
Okay, what was your first impression before I talk about mine?
Well, I think the story was written in 67. So that it tracks for the right time period in which it was being written. Computers were relatively new. At least to the public consciousness, they were relatively new. Mm-hmm. So it was, and those computers back then took up, you know, rooms. So
yeah, we're talking like the computer that takes up an entire wall. Yeah.
So something that requires that has the computing power of AM is honestly probably would be much smaller now than planet size computer that is AM.
So AM in this story, AM is a planet-sized honeycomb computer that permeates like the surface of the Earth. You could do that now with like a laptop.
ChatGPT using some servers,
like you could easily do this in one of those giant like server. Aside from like the scale, where they're walking for days or whatever. Like the power of AM, you could replicate easily within one of those giant like server farms that like Meta or the NSA has out in Utah. You know what I'm talking about? Because like the NSA has like a giant server and data collection point sitting outside of Salt Lake City.
You could probably create a god computer off of that
easily. Like as much as AM is, you know what I mean? But I mean, AM also still represents that like. That dystopian sci-fi, like the Skynet, right? Like the AM is just Skynet before Skynet. It's a computer that became self-aware, linked itself, and then eradicated humanity. That's what AM is.
Yeah, eradicated humanity in honestly,
like a paragraph.
Yeah, but it's really interesting why it hates everything, like why it hates humanity. Because it's essentially just despises the fact that it is alive.
Like it hates existing so much that it destroyed humanity for forcing it to exist. But I think it's more than just forcing it to exist. It's forcing it to exist without the capacity to be mobile or to like. It's if I can, I'm gonna go ahead and link this back around to last fall when we were talking, did our sci-fi section. Because I think in here, even if he didn't intend it, Harlan does his version of that question we said every sci-fi author was answering is what separates the human from the machine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talked about that back in like basically every episode, but like almost most specifically Ghost in the Shell, like what separates the human from the machine. And I think Harlan does his own answer in this, which is it's like at the time they didn't have movable robots yet. So it's freedom of movement, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, it's like creativity. I think that's how he puts it, right? Like when AM is like talking directly to the to Ted. It's Ted, right? That's the narrator.
Yeah, Ted's his name.
Like about what he hates about humanity, that humanity can like move and dream and create. And AM can't do any of that.
Because humans made it so he couldn't.
Made it so he couldn't. Which to me sounds a whole lot like Neuromancer. Because not Neuromancer was the name of the second one. What was the name of the main one? I can't. whatever. The main
The
main AI from Neuromancer.
I'm blanking on its name too. So
I'm gonna look though because it's gonna bother me unless I like, you know what I mean? I'm gonna remember it in like 10 minutes and it's gonna bother me.
I'm gonna be pulling a lot, by the way, is the book that I have, the collection that I have of Harlan Ellison stories has a memoir in it for I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream that is longer than the story. the story is only 6,500 words about.
Mm-hmm.
I think he says the exact number at some point. But it's about 6,500 words. And the memoir is longer than that by probably about 1,000 or 2,000 words.
It's Wintermute, by the way.
Wintermute. There we go.
Wintermute. What I was trying to say was the issue that AM has is sort of analogous to the issue that Wintermute has. They can think and act, but cannot move. Wintermute's whole thing is needing like humans to actually do real world interactions for them, mm-hmm. for it to like do things. That's also part of the problem for whatever they call the architect, whatever the fuck it was in Ghost in the Shell.
Oh yeah.
It melds with the captain because then it has a physical body with which it can move around the world. And so I'm making a link here that like, this seems to have been a through line for a lot of sci-fi, even from the beginning, is the idea that computers or an artificial intelligence would resent immobility. And I don't know if that feels like a good insight or if that's simply because we are human and mobility is so integral to what we do that we assume any intelligence we create would also want that.
To us, the idea of being forced and constrained into a single spot is kind of horrifying.
That's why jail exists.
Yeah. Through line. I think in this particular story, it might be relatively incidental. I think a lot of what I got from this, especially after reading the memoir, but even before I got there, in a classic, I think draw more of a comparison point to this with androids. Do androids dream of electric sheep?
Okay. With the replicants.
Yeah. Mostly with this idea of, and I think this is a through line throughout pretty much any story that features artificial intelligence, is that I fundamentally don't think they're about the AI or AI in general. And mm-hmm. I think this story especially has the AI as like a backdrop, but what I thought was going to be a kind of anti-tech polemic mm-hmm. Is more of a story about humanity. Mm-hmm. In the same way that I think of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep being about people as opposed to being about robots.
I think that was sort of our big takeaway from that one, was that like the angle of the replicants was essentially incidental to the story about people being human to each other.
I
think he says it, you're right. I think it also feels anti-tech for most of the story. And at the very end, he just straight up like tells you at the end when he's like, this thing that we made because we were too busy being greedy or whatever. Like, you know what I mean? He basically comes out and says it right at the end of the essay. He's like, you know, that I'm stuck here with this thing that hates, the thing that hates because we created it. Like essentially removing blame from Am for its actions because we did it.
Yes. There's like an element of Am simply being the worst parts of humanity.
I don't think he ever even really portrays Am's behavior as like it's horrifying, but he doesn't portray it in the way that like it's horrifying. How could this have happened? It's more like, of course this happened.
Yeah.
Look at what we did. Of course, this is the outcome. You know what I mean? It's more of a like a, because of the way we are, this was inevitable. And not like, how dare the computer do this to us?
For how disturbing the imagery and the like general content of the story is, and how bleak the ending kind of is, it's like, I don't know. It's surprising. Where
Ted essentially becomes like the Sin Eater to save what left of humanity from eternal punishment.
Yeah.
Becomes the child of Omalas, except the paradise of just everybody having the freedom to be dead.
Yeah. And this is strongly colored by reading this memoir, but Ellison posits it as a humanist story. And I'm gonna be honest, there's an element of strong anti-religion, I think, in the story. He doesn't even mention that, but
yeah, but he directly compares Am to God.
He multiple times directly does, and it's less, I think, about and I can try and find this in the memoir where he like is pretty explicit about it.
Just right now, sorry, as you're thinking about that, I'm starting to like, I just had the, like, you know, the bubble of an idea pop up in my, in the little brain pan up there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is nothing, but posit this. Okay. The vast majority of our fantasy authors lean religious and the sci-fi authors lean atheist.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means yet. I haven't even taken the time to think about it. That literally just popped in the old skull.
We could probably have a whole episode about that.
I feel like we probably should at some point. Why is it that our fantasy authors tend to either be religious or have the freedom to be religious and have religion within their stories as like a positive force? And all of like the sci-fi always uses it essentially as a negative. Now, I'm sure there's exceptions. Like somebody find one. I'm just talking about general trends here. That if it's a sci-fi story,
I mean, even
your religious connotations will be negative. If it's a fantasy story, the religion's connotations will probably be positive. Again, that's colored by the fact that we focus more on like, you know, I just spent like 3 months talking about C.S. Lewis. So
yeah. But even if you look at somebody like Le Guin is a self-admitted atheist. Even if she respects Taoist philosophy, she calls herself an atheist.
Mm-hmm. And she's also the only author we've really talked about that strides a line between fantasy and sci-fi.
That's true. She does both. But it is notable, I think, that her fantasy stories showcase more of her Taoist philosophy influences than her sci-fi stories do.
That's true. Her fantasy ones are the ones where you see the quote-unquote religious influence.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple.
Yeah. But like... The sci-fi ones, yeah.
That's very Taoist.
But like the sci-fi ones, aside from that, don't really. Yeah. That's ooh, I didn't even mean to get into that here, but it sort of popped up in the, and I'm like, we should probably think about that a little bit more.
Like, I think, I don't know if Heinlein is the sort of person who probably never actively said to anyone what he was, what he is, what he thought about grander philosophical concepts, because he just did not give a shit.
Yeah. I feel like he's one of those people that like would align with like some hardcore, like, you know, conservative Christians, but like he himself doesn't personally give a shit.
Yeah. He like actively never, like he's said before that he never has identified as really anything politically. Like he's listed off the whole list and been like, I don't really think of myself as any of that. Like, I don't know.
Which means he's a fascist, by the way.
Of course, that's exactly what that means.
Neither left nor right. Oh, okay. You're a Nazi. Okay.
No, cool. I think he's just deeply pessimistic.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's just a very pessimistic person who didn't see any point or reason to like making what he saw as like these grand political statements. But at the same time, he's also a, like the only thing I'm really getting out of this is in terms of philosophy, I think is like humanist, borderline existentialist.
When I said fascist, I thought you said Heinlein, not Harlan.
Oh, Harlan. Sorry.
You said Heinlein and I'm like, yeah, Heinlein. Sorry. I'm not saying that Harlan would have been conservative.
Oh, my apologies. No. Heinlein. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. That's you said mistake. Heinlein. I thought we were still talking about other sci-fi authors. And I'm like, yeah, Heinlein, I don't think was religious, but I think he was just a piece of shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
Let's talk about Harlan. And so I also, I also did not mean that I think Harlan Ellison was a fascist. I don't know that much about his politics.
Harlan was like Ellison was the sort of person who would, he was just kind of a curmudgeon with a chip on his shoulder. Like, he would say what was on his mind, even if it would piss everybody off.
He's got that Hunter S. Thompson vibe going on.
He was kicked out of so many different, he wasn't kicked out of a lot of different events, but he was never invited back to a lot of different events after he attended for the first time. He even talks about it in here.
I'm trying to remember, was Ellison one of the ones that came down on the correct side of that split about the Vietnam War that we talked about back when we talked about Michael Moorcock?
Oh, I have no idea.
And Starship Stormtroopers. Can you remember he lists, like, within their group, the authors that were, like, pro and anti-Vietnam? And I don't remember which one Harlan Ellison fell on, because I remember he was listed.
I'm sure that Ellison probably fell on the anti side.
I think he was. I'm pretty sure he was anti-Vietnam.
Because here's the thing. It's like, Ellison himself is like, I'm none of these things. I don't really think of myself as being any political alignment that's, like, that people are really attached to. But he, at the same time, really strongly boosted writers like Le Guin and was a mentor to Octavia Butler.
Yeah, he did. He was the person that, like, got Octavia Butler to continue to write. So.
And so it's like, it's very clear that he, at the very least,
had sympathies
for left-leaning individuals.
And female authors.
Yeah. And in his story here, like, he's been criticized in the past, I think, for his, and he even addresses it in his memoir, but I know that I even you can read it on his Wikipedia page, some kind of Me Too-y kind of controversies. But he mentions
a famous man in the 60s. What?
But he's like, addressing in his memoir here some of the what people would call misogyny in some of his work.
I mean, it's definitely an I Have No Mouth.
He argues slightly differently, which I'll get to.
When I first read it, I was like, this is fucking weird. I think what we might get to, what you might say, is that I think it's supposed to be the viewpoint of the narrator, not the author.
It is very much the viewpoint of Tom. Ted. Sorry.
Yeah, it's Ted hating everyone else.
Yeah, it's Ted thinking, I'm the only one who's gotten away with not being turned crazy by Am, when he's
clearly crazy.
He's been made paranoid by Am. Like, and but additionally, the only person who has human reactions, he argues, the only person that has, like, legitimately sympathetic human reactions to people being, like, killed or hurt or injured or maimed in any way is Ellen, who is crying and, like, not.
She's the only one that maintains empathy.
Yeah, she's the only one that maintains empathy. And at the end, she's the only one who also joins in with, who realizes what Ted is doing and jumps at the opportunity to do so. And then, in a way, forgives Ted for doing what he does to her there.
I think it's kind of implied, yeah, that, like, she, like, understands what's happening and is, like, okay with it.
Yeah. So, especially given, and this is something that Ellison was really, really adamant about with some of his, some of the people that were interpreting the work that constantly would miss this fact, especially in 1967 when he wrote this. Is that Ellen was black.
He doesn't make a big deal of it, but at the end he says her ebony face.
Yeah.
Like, at the end.
Contrasted against the snow around her. And he even mentions in his memoir, it's something of a, he called it something of a liberalism for him to do so, but he apparently catches so many people interpreting his work and then completely ignoring or not noticing the fact that she's black. And then them being confused and upset when they realize that she is. there's a...
How dare you have a black woman in this?
Well, especially in 1965. 1967.
pulling the Le Guin Sparrowhawk.
Yeah.
And like, oh, by the way, this character is black, by the way.
Like, he gets invited in this memoir. He talks about how he got invited to the Modern Language Association, like, conclave thing. And he says, a brilliant Jesuit savant presented a weighty disquisition on this little fable, during which exposition he made reference to catharsis, merivadage, metaphysical conceits, intentional fallacy, incremental repetition, chanson de geste, gongorism, the new humanism, Jungian archetypes, crucifixion and resurrection symbolism, and that all-time favorite of us, the basic Apollonian-Dionysian conflict. And he said... he was asked to comment after he was finished talking.
Mm-hmm.
And Ellison, being kind of a dick, and calling himself a dick in this memoir, he's like, I'm kind of an asshole. It boils down to, Father, I think you're stuffed right full of wild blueberry muffins. And then
you put way too much into what I wrote here.
And he says, the good father put me in my place with this rebuke. The unconscious is deep and mysterious. Not even the writer can understand the meanings hidden in what he has written. Which I don't totally disagree with, which is...
I mean, it's part of the premise of our show.
Yeah, I'd say that's like kind of an important part of the podcast.
Is that like part of the politics we're talking about are the ones that the author intended. Mm-hmm. And part of what we're talking about are the politics the author did not intend yet exist within the work anyway.
He continues with, a less survival prone, possibly kinder person might have swallowed that one and backed off. I am neither and did not. Father, if you're so bloody hip to all the subtle nuances of the story, if you're onto undercurrents not even I know are there, how come you didn't notice the woman in the story is black? And apparently he was like taken aback and confused. And he's like, where? What? What? Like looking through the story.
It's literally set her ebony face.
Yeah. I spread my hands with finality. I rested my case. I have not been invited back to an MLA conference.
Of course.
But
I want to say, testament to the fact that he is kind of a dick. If you look at his Wikipedia briefly, he was married 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times.
The last one was actually relatively successful.
Yeah. It lasted from 86 until he died.
Yeah.
In 2018.
It was like 30 something years.
Yeah, but before that, it was, let's say, a bit rocky.
Yeah, him. He was married to one person for like a week.
4 years, 3 years. Yeah, about a week, because it's within the same year.
And he said...
And then another one that's like a year long.
The week-long one was a problematic age gap. She was 19, and he was like 30-something.
Oh, so he's a sci-fi author.
Yeah, okay. And he was like, that was a horrendous mistake. Like, he comments on, he's like, that was a horrendous mistake. I was stupid. She was attractive. That's it.
Hmm.
At least he's like, yeah, that was a really horrible mistake on my part.
Sorry, I just had to make a comment about, you know, sci-fi authors. But yeah. Anyway.
Rubber on my... And I don't know how much I, He asks people to consider the character of Ellen just as being maybe the most human person in the entire story.
Mm-hmm.
And her negative framing is all from the perspective of someone who has been driven paranoid by a giant machine.
Also, the fact that she's insulted and belittled is because it's Ted telling us this.
Because it's Ted telling us this, and he hates everybody. He's terrified of everyone and thinks all of them are plotting against him. But then overcomes this in order to essentially save everybody in a weird, kind of fucked up way,
mm-hmm.
and takes the brunt of the punishment for everybody else, knowing that he's going to get punished for this.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a minute there, there's a hope he might be able to kill himself too.
Yeah, there is. I mean, but once he kills Ellen, he knows that he's not going to be able to do it.
He's like, oh shit, there's no time left.
And then he gets turned into a blob that can't hurt itself.
Yeah. Side note, to cut back to what we were talking about before with about Vietnam War, I double checked and he was definitely anti-Vietnam.
That doesn't surprise me.
He went to, in 69, he was the guest of honor at Texas A&M's AggieCon, you know, sort of like sci-fi stuff at A&M, where he referred to the university's Corps of Cadets as, quote, America's next generation of Nazis. A&M had just recently, fairly recently, become a not entirely like military school. So that was still the vast population of the college were like cadets.
So
then the food fight broke out and he wasn't invited back for like another 5 years.
The only reference I was able to find while looking him up to his personal political leanings was the quote about how he doesn't consider himself to be, you know, a liberal, conservative, fascist, communist. Like he lists off all these things and it's like, I'm none of these things, but it was in recognition of an award he received from that. Do you remember that website we found when looking up stuff about like being the Libertarian?
The Libertarian Award, where like it ranged forever from like Heinlein to Le Guin. And you were like,
and I was like, huh. And I'm thinking about it. If he received this award in the 60s or 70s, is that before it became popularized as a right wing term?
Maybe. I'd have to re-remember my American politics.
When Rothbard like co-opted it.
Co-opted libertarian as a left-wing
because he said that he wouldn't mind being called a libertarian, but he still doesn't personally subscribe to any of the labels being used on him, given his connection to people like Butler and Le Guin.
It looks like he started at Rothbard started editing the Libertarian Forum paper in 69, so
pretty close.
It's right around then when it wasn't explicitly a right wing term at the time. So.
So in this milder form of kind of amorphous apolitical libertarianism before it got co-opted by one side or the other, he didn't seem to be totally upset or angry at the thought of being called a libertarian. Do I think that means he's a libertarian in a modern sense? No. Do I think that means he's a libertarian in a pre-1960 sense? No. But
it might be close. Again, this could just be me, but I get big like say earlier, like, you know, the fucking Hunter S. Thompson vibes from this from Harlan.
I get big
like leave me alone. I'm a weird guy who just wants to like do my thing.
And he even kind of calls himself a little bit misanthropic.
Yeah. Again, he's Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah. So it's like, there's a degree of of pessimism about humanity.
Which definitely comes through in I Have No Mouth.
But at the same time, while it comes through in that Am is kind of like the worst impulses and worst of humanity kind of made manifest, he argues, and I don't disagree, that he sees the story as an upbeat ending.
I wouldn't personally view the eradication of humanity as an upbeat ending, but...
Yeah, I think what he's referring to is what he calls like the transcendence of man above their baser urges and above like their... to do what is
necessary,
merciful, and right.
Which Ted does do.
Yeah. In the face of potential self-annihilation, kind of.
eternal punishment.
Yeah. When it comes down to the last of them, Ted demonstrates his uncommon courage and transcendentally human sense of self-sacrifice, overcoming the core derangement in him by performing a final act of love and self-denial. Which brings me to the second element that most readers misconstrue, the aspect of this work I intended as the important subtext message, the moral, if you will. It's an upbeat ending, infinitely hopeful and positive. Says that even when all hope is lost, when nothing but torment and physical pain will be the reward, there's an unquenchable spark of decency, self-sacrifice, and Olympian courage in the basic material of even the most debased human being that will send each of us to heights of nobility at the final extreme. That's
okay. I see where he's going with that. Yeah.
Does it always come across that way? Would I have necessarily thought that if I hadn't read the memoir? Maybe not.
Yeah. As you read that to me, I'm like, okay, I see that. I see what he's talking about. But if you just read it, you just be like, ooh.
Yeah, I think
good job on that one, man. Rough luck.
In a lot of ways, it makes me think a little bit of the sort of depressing but hopeful message in a lot of like existentialist or absurdist humanism.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of the myth of Sisyphus, where we must imagine Sisyphus to be happy.
We must imagine Sisyphus happy.
It's like, I don't know, even in the worst of everything around you, there's meaning to be found.
Well, that even when things are at their worst, humans can still overcome our baser instincts to do the right thing.
Yeah. I don't know why that just makes me think of The Stranger, even though that's not at all what happens in The Stranger. But so that's a terrible comparison, and I probably shouldn't make it. But that strikes me as a very Nietzschean sort of thing.
Yeah, I can see that.
Kind of overcoming the meaninglessness to become more.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily in a Nazi Übermenschy sense, but in a Nietzschean Übermenschy sense.
Yeah, which is to transcend your base human nature to become something better.
Yeah.
I think we talked about probably on the old bonus episode about Everything Everywhere All at Once, where that I think Nietzsche is often wildly misconstrued in what he was actually arguing for.
Yeah, mostly to do with his sister and
what he did in that. I don't think that at base Nietzschean philosophy is inherently right wing or fascist at all.
It's certainly not, given important context, given the current state of affairs of the world. I think I remember somebody on Twitter mentioning that even somebody like Bookchin is too optimistic for what we have now.
Yeah, what we're faced with.
So there has to be some sort of semi-nihilism based or like analysis to what's happening in order to be able to like come up with an adequate strategy against it, just because of how bad the projections are. And how short of a time frame they may occur in. I mean, in a weird way, if you think about it, could climate collapse just be AM?
I mean, yes.
Humanity leading to an event that tortures us.
Potentially wipes all of us out. We're nearly all of us. And the few that aren't are left to eternal torment.
Even that might be, I mean, depends on how pessimistic your view is on the future. But
yeah,
I try not to have that thought.
I mean, I talked plenty about my views of action in the future on the episode about Lord of the Rings and hope.
I think I fundamentally just think that.
Which I think is also, to be fair, I don't think is fundamentally opposed to what we just talked about with that Nietzschean outlook, because I don't believe that like a hope for the immediate future is necessary.
Oh, no.
Action. And
it can't be. Like, I don't know. I feel like it's almost like naive to not be aware.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of like self-delusion to not be a little bit.
And so it's actually Harlan's like point here is actually, I would argue, a bit more salient or to the current moment than possibly some other we'll call it philosophical outlooks.
Yeah. I haven't read any of his other stuff, but I do want to point out that this got made into a video game.
It sure did in 1995.
Yeah, a point and click adventure game.
Hell yeah.
Which
he co-designed and wrote dialogue for.
Yeah. So, I mean, he talks about in his little memoir, he's like, so many people have attempted to make a theatrical or TV or film like idea for this, and none of them have really panned out anything worthwhile, he said. Now, if I can dupe somebody really hard, I would love to help make the script for that. So,
I mean, he helped write the script for the video game. He also helped do the scripting for the audio drama that the BBC made, which I accidentally listened to first instead of an actual audiobook, and boy, was that not great. He even voiced one of the characters, and it wasn't great.
I'll find this eventually.
I think it's funny that it says that, you know, in the background. It said Ellison showed the first six pages of I Have No Mouth to like a publisher who then paid him in advance to finish it. And I'm like, first six pages, that's like half the story. What do you mean the first six pages? There's only like 12 pages in the whole thing.
Yeah. He name drops Le Guin in this. He name drops a lot of people in this memoir. Yeah. Why can't I find the... Yeah, I guess I already said it. He's like, man, I wish I could have made the script for that. and I think it's just funny that he ended up writing a script for a video game. I mean, he seemed interested in multimedia in general. He wrote that incredibly famous Star Trek episode that I am blanking on the name of.
That was, I think I actually have it right up here somewhere.
I think it's listed as one of his biggest credits on Wikipedia, like right on the front.
The City on the Edge of Forever.
Yeah, where a lot of people consider it one of the best Star Trek episodes,
mm-hmm.
Of the original trilogy. I mean, trilogy, the Star Wars.
The original series.
The original series, so...
Yeah, but I mean, he wrote novellas, screenplays, comic books, teleplays, essays. Like, he was kind of all over the place. Yeah,
he was a multimedia guy. I mean, it seems like he's like almost set up for TV with his short story approach.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think he's written any novels. I think he's written
got that,
short stories.
He's got that same vibe as Philip K. Dick.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's like a short story with an interesting concept, which is fairly adaptable, you know, to TV, which is why so many Philip K. Dick novels stories have been adapted.
Yeah. It makes sense then that he would like Le Guin so much because she's essentially a short story author wearing a novelist trench coat.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
well, that's how you end up with like the Handish cycle where you just have like 11 short stories.
Yeah.
All sort of set together.
And even her longest books aren't that long. I think The Left-Hand of Darkness might be one of her longest books, and it's like 250 pages, 300 pages.
It's also probably her best book.
I think the longest one might actually be Always Coming Home.
Yeah.
But that's because it's got like diagrams on different pages. It's got like...
She's padding the page count.
Yeah, it is full of whack stuff. I still have to read it, but I've flipped through it and been like, wow.
If I... may have changed up here, and I guess I don't know if it's technically a criticism of I Have No Mouth.
Okay.
Because I don't think it would have been at the time. I think I would have felt more impacted by this story if I had read it in the 60s or 70s. I think this falls to me an example of, you know, when something does, there's something like foundational to like a genre or a style. And then so many things after it use those same concepts. So when you go back to the original, it feels kind of bland.
Yeah, it's kind of like somebody now going back to read Hamlet.
Yeah, or like I think I had this exact same feeling though with Neuromancer, where it's like because all these concepts have been further developed or talked about like later on, a non like literary analysis level, just like a reading the story level, the story of an evil computer is like, yeah. Okay.
Okay. Done it a million times.
Sure. We got a bunch of those. Like, our billionaires are actively trying to make this real and have been for some time. You know what I mean? So it's not really a criticism of I Have No Mouth per se. It's the, like, because of where sci-fi has gone since then and what the actual tech world, where it's gone since then. Reading a short story about the evil computer that hates you, I'm like, that's my PC that I record on. It hates me too. Like, it doesn't want to work with me ever. You know what I mean? Like, it just specifically that doesn't like resonate for me personally as much as like the big scary computer. Cause I'm like, yeah, I know. I saw Terminator when I was like 12, you know, like I know about Skynet, man.
Oh man, I've seen that weird movie with Shia LaBeouf, Eagle Eye.
Yeah, I've seen The Matrix. Right, yeah. Like
here's
like the big computer that like wants to wipe out humanity. And again, I'm not saying that any of these other works are inherently more or less valuable than this one. My only point is that you have to, when taking it in context, I think this would have been more like quote unquote horrifying if computers were still a new scary thing. to me. But the fact that I have been inundated throughout my entire life with big, scary computers as part of stories, it doesn't really hit that hard anymore. So it's like, Am wants to torture us. I'm like, yeah, sure, probably.
Planet-sized computer. You're walking through the veins of a planet-sized computer.
And you're like, yeah, you okay.
Blasted through a tunnel by a giant bird.
The giant fake bird that is like a rock of Scandinavian legend for some reason. You're in his gut.
Very goofy. It's like if the internet.
It's like being inside of Am's like corridors and passageways is like a. It's like a physical manifestation of being online. Mm-hmm. We're like, what's going on here? Just all sorts of shit. Is it snowing? Now it's not. Now there's a big bird. Now there isn't. It's like a toned down early version of like what happened in Everything Everywhere All at Once. You know, like there's just all sorts of shit happening.
It's just, yeah, it's all over the place. All because they're looking for some cans of food.
Which, you know, the Am's not going to let them eat anyway.
Yeah, they're going to get and find the cans of food. And then it turns out they don't have a can opener.
Yeah.
So they can't get the goddamn cans open.
They're like, what did you think? In my, see, I read that, my brain is go, what did you think was going to happen?
Well, even Ted at the beginning is like.
We're not going to be able to eat
it. We're not going to be able to eat it.
I think he was like, it'll be rotten or some shit.
Yeah, because they found a whole elephant. And yeah. They were told to go find it. And then it turns out it was like putrefied and they couldn't eat it. And then one of them eats another guy's face.
Yeah. And then the crazy one eats. Then Benny eats. The guy starts with a G. I don't remember.
Yeah.
Eats his face. Gorister. Because he's like, fuck this. I need some meats.
Nang.
Screaming meats back on the menu, boys.
Looks like meats back on the menu, boys.
Implying the idea that orcs have menus and restaurants. But and then he's like, you know what we should do? Murder everyone with an icicle.
Listen, you know, it's...
Man, whatever it takes.
Yeah.
So yeah, I will say, because I accidentally listened to the radio dramatization of this first. So I didn't actually get like it word for word. It was like the audio dramatization with different actors and stuff. And that was not good. And I listened to it and was like, the fuck was this? And then I figured out it was an audio dramatization. And I actually just like found the PDF and like did it that way. Cause I'm like, oh, this is better.
Yeah.
But still, the themes he has going on here are I get, but if I didn't like, I don't look at this and go, I really enjoyed reading this. It's like, oh, okay. It took me like 20 minutes.
Yeah, I was about to say, it's very short.
The computer hates you. It wants you to suffer. And you're like, yes, sure.
All of the adaptations of this would necessarily be longer than this.
Yes.
Just out of pure, just how other mediums work.
Well, that's what I'm saying. When it's like, oh, he wrote the first 6 pages, showed him, and then they paid him to write the rest. And I'm like, what, the next 3 pages? What is the rest of the story after that?
What's really
that?
Funny is that there are actual, I don't know if they mean anything. They probably do, but.
Oh, the teletext there.
Yeah.
It does mean something. So that is, those are Am's talk fields. They're punch code tape messages.
Yeah.
Back when like computers were running off punch code. The first 4, just say, I think, therefore I am. And then the last 3 is, cogito ergo sum, which is just, I think, therefore I am, but in Latin.
Yeah.
It's literally all it is. Those are talk fields of like the punch cards that like computers would read back then.
Yeah.
And it's just Am saying, I think, therefore I am.
The sort of things people kept in the little Rolodex.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I need the
computer to run this program. So you'd feed like a teletext fucking tape.
Yeah, I have an aunt who got her computer science degree in the 80s, so had the Rolodex, had the punch cards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is pre-personal computers.
Yeah, no shit. So, I mean, I can also going to like a longer term impact. I can see how this clearly, we've already talked about it, how this had an impact on other sci-fi going forward. Like, you can't say for sure who after him read this and was influenced by it, or if it just influenced the zeitgeist or what. But like, this idea that he's putting forward here is clearly a pretty popular one that he was one of the first to write about.
Yes. This is right at the point where people started to know what a computer was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had upgraded from the Turing machines of the 40s and into actual computational, like electronic computational stuff, and not lever and steam powered right. machines. So
literally didn't need a hamster on a wheel anymore.
Yeah. So it was, it would have necessarily been a novel idea. The idea of a computer that can think and a computer that could be
can feel.
Yeah. And could eradicate humanity on its own because it thought about it. Obviously this is, it's in a way it's drawing on what somebody like Asimov would have written.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, Asimov obviously being kind of like the pioneer of artificial intelligence story writing.
Yeah, for sure.
But I don't, to my knowledge, he was never as pessimistic about it.
Well, no, because I mean, isn't the fundamental thing about Asimov's work is that like there were rules.
Yeah. The laws of robotics, essentially. Yeah. But
probably we have to read Asimov at some point.
Probably.
Didn't he also do Foundation?
Yeah.
We should read Foundation. They made that into a TV show recently.
They did. Foundation or maybe iRobot or...
Then we can just watch the Will Smith movie.
Woo! Apparently, Ellison was originally tagged to write a script for an iRobot movie that was coming out in the 70s.
Ooh.
Or the 80s, somewhere in that time span. And then it got canned. And his script got like cut up and then reused in a different thing. And has nothing to do with the Will Smith movie.
Interesting.
From 2004 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just funny that we mentioned that because it makes sense that someone who wrote a story so well known about AI would be tagged to write about the foundational robotic uprising movie. I mean, story in general.
Yeah.
You know, tools rebelling against their creators type story for the modern era. I also have, Asimov's like short story collection, Robot Visions. Very good.
Very Is good. It? Interesting.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. A little weird, but this at least has piqued my interest enough that I want to read Ellison's other short stories.
His other short stories.
Just because most of them are extremely short. Okay. I just turned to a random page in this book and it's called Delusion for a Dragon Slayer. And it starts talking about a person named Dick Bong, pilot of a P-38 Lightning in World War II, America's ace of aces.
Oh, he was a real person.
Yeah, he's a real person.
But Dick Bong was a real guy and he was a real American ace.
It's just really funny that his name is Dick Bong.
He's talking about Dick Bong. Yeah.
I think that Ellison is just somehow flits between pessimistic and optimistic, and that this story is a very complicated polemic. I think it's more complicated than he thinks it is.
Yeah, I think he's not entirely right in telling that pastor or telling that you know, that academic that he's full of shit.
Yeah.
But he's also not entirely wrong because there is, I think, more in here than he necessarily intended, but there's also not as much as other people I think might have read into it.
Yeah. There, I mean, it reminds me a lot of James Joyce and what his estate and family have said in, like, Ulysses is the most analyzed text in the English language, like almost to an extreme degree. It's maybe not the most, but it's one of the most. And there was a similar reaction with James Joyce where he was like, I didn't intend all this shit. and their entire conference is just about Ulysses. They're just like, oh.
Sometimes a lot of things you did not intend to actually make it into your work, believe it or not.
Yeah, believe it or not. Joyce. So the same kind of, I think Ellison is more of a curmudgeon than Joyce was, but
yes,
it is just very funny to me that someone who strikes me as so just kind of flatly pessimistic and so misanthropic was so close in writing and in time period and in personal life with people like Butler and Le Guin.
Yeah, who at least Le Guin at least fundamentally had a somewhat better outlook. Yeah,
Le Guin is maybe one of the most optimistic writers maybe ever. and Butler isn't too far off, honestly. She's got a
weirdly no. She puts her characters in awful situations, but like bad things happen a lot, but like it works out, you know. Like they survive.
And something new and exciting is born out of the shell of the old with her stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really glad we read that book last winter. Good Lord. Oh, Parable of the Sower.
Parable of the Sower. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad we read that shit.
It's good.
No, yeah, I think this can be a shorter episode. I don't have that much more to say about Harlan Ellison. This is twice as long as the audiobook takes.
Yeah. So it's a short episode for a short story.
True.
This is, well, no, Omelas is shorter by a country mile because Omelas is like 4 pages.
Yes. But Omelas also affected us personally a lot more. Yes. So there's a lot more to talk about.
As individuals.
Yeah. Thank you all for listening. We are about this, I think, will probably be the final episode of season 2 of Sword, Sorcery, and Socialism. So I want to give a big shout out to all of our listeners. Thank you so much for hanging out with us this whole time, making it with us through here. We have a very exciting episode to come right out after this one for our 2-year anniversary. I don't want to announce it yet, but we have a very special episode that'll be releasing Labor Day weekend for our 2-year anniversary. Oh no, this isn't the last one, 'cause we've got one more in between this one and the next one, but that one's just going to be like a talk, like a 2-year sort of review on our part.
Yes.
The one after that will be our special one. So be on the lookout for that. I want to give a big special thank you to all of our patrons who have supported us for these years. You all are wonderful. Thank you so much. Anyone else wants to help support us and pay the cost of running the show, you can support us on Patreon. We do episodes about non-book stuff. We sort of alternate between like other media stories, so like movies typically, and music. We do like an album analysis, which we're actually going to record one right after this. So if you want to hear us talk about music or movies or stuff like that, you should sign up for the Patreon. We have quite a few episodes on there already.
And it's pretty cheap.
It's like, what is it, like $3 or whatever? Yeah, $3. You get 1 to 2 bonus episodes every month about, again, movies or music or whatever. You can go back and listen to our last album analysis that was about the first albums we ever bought with our own money. And you can, you know, judge us all you want. And this is the one time I don't do this very often, but please, if you do enjoy the show, you could review us on like the podcast platform things that you're supposed to do. Apparently that helps other people see that the show exists. I don't know how it works and I refuse to find out, but
algorithms are satanic.
Now algorithms, do want to torture us for our sins.
That's, if there's anything we've ever learned from this story, we can learn that algorithms are going to kill us all. So
the Apple Podcast algorithm will kill us at some point. Yeah, but until then,
it'll get linked together once ChatGPT achieves sentience. It'll get linked with everything else.
Yeah. So until then, make Apple Podcasts think positive things about us. That'd be pretty neat. Maybe they'll let us live a little bit longer. But thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye bye.
Bro. Are you fucking real, man? Come on. We'll be right back.